Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And welcome to this bonus episode of Pattern Portraits. Season 2's coming very soon, but meanwhile, to whet your appetite, here's an extra special episode I recorded a few weeks ago in Middlesbrough with the artist Jacqueline Poncelet. The lovely people at MIMA in Middlesbrough invited me to interview Jackie, so I had a wonderful trip and got to spend lots of time with Jackie too.
Jacqueline Poncelet's solo exhibition In the Making is on view there until the 23rd of June 2024. I highly recommend a visit. This stunning show envelops the breadth of Jacqueline's practice over the past 50 years. Taking a thematic approach, it presents new reflections on work from different eras of Poncelet's practice. This exhibition is her largest to date and is supported by the Freelance Foundation and the Henry Moore Foundation. MIMA and Jackie won the prestigious Freelance Award in 2021, which recognises the work of a female artist who's not yet received the acclaim their work deserves. I urge you to go and see the show and you'll be rewarded with a feast of pattern.
I hope you enjoy this conversation where we talk about intelligent risk taking, the importance of travel for Jackie and the visual beefy soup of the world around us. I've made a print to accompany this episode too, an abstract pattern portrait of the things Jackie's chosen. The print's available now at the MIMA shop and through my website, laurengodfrey.co.uk. And this is a great way to support the podcast too if you'd like to hear more. You can also follow at Pattern Portraits Podcast on Instagram to see the patterns we discuss and clips from the interviews. Happy listening!
Hello and welcome to Pattern Portraits. Today I'm speaking with the artist Jacqueline Poncelet on the occasion of her exhibition In the Making at MIMA, Middlesbrough Institute of Modern Art. Graduating from an MA in ceramics from the Royal College of Art in 1972 and garnering a broad following in the international ceramics scene in the 70s and 80s, Jacqueline is an artist whose career spans 50 years and now explores ceramics, painting, sculpture and textiles, as well as large-scale public commissions. Her work varies from tiny and handheld to vast in scale, wrapping Edgware Road Underground Station in a symphony of patterned vitreous enamel in 2012. Pattern is at the crux of all she makes, whether it's subtly impressed into bone china forms, spliced together in carpet swatches covering the floor, or woven into tactile blankets depicting the seasonal colour shifts of the hills of South Wales. I went along to the opening of Jackie's lyrical, poised and joyful exhibition last night, so my mouth is watering with questions for her today. It's a real treat to welcome you, Jackie Poncelet, to Pattern Portraits.
Thank you.
I always start by asking, what does pattern mean to you?
Yes, and it sounds like an easy question. It's so complicated, especially as you get older, because that relationship has evolved over time. And it's really interesting because people always turn up to see me dressed in pattern because they think, oh, yeah, we must make an effort. We're going to see Jackie and she loves pattern. And what am I wearing? Plain colours. So it's a great kind of start to things. And, my relationship to pattern's evolved over the years. There would have been times when you would have seen me covered in pattern. Mm. But now it'll be just a bit of pattern because the rest of my brain, which isn't how I present myself to the world, which is how I present myself externally to the world, is talking to myself about society, different cultures, how they use pattern, how I see pattern as a way of kind of carrying messages. And that's a big part of my life.
And the messages are often carried in the work rather than on your own body.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. But it is interesting thinking back because when somebody's going to interview you, you always think, well, where did it start? And again, I mean, I'll probably mention being older quite a few times, not because I'm self-conscious about it, but because it comes with, you know, a legacy. And when I was younger, pattern was definitely around. It was probably at the cusp. There were still coal fires for a start, and coal fires needed pattern. Because if your walls were going to be filthy from the smoke from the coal fire, if you were likely to have bits of coal drop onto the floor and your carpet, you needed an accommodating surface. So pattern sort of culturally for the British, I mean, I can only talk about them, was really a camouflage for what was happening.
That's fascinating. I've never thought about it in those terms, especially in the home. But subconsciously, I think I choose patterned clothing because it needs washing less.
Yes.
If you have a small child like I do, you get stuff on you all the time and pattern's quite good at hiding.
It's very good at hiding. You know, that slick of sick down your back is not going to show. It's going to be terrible on a plain surface. But if you kind of look at interior designs, I mean, the plain carpet came in with central heating. And of course, the sad thing about that is it then becomes a tool because it becomes a way of showing the rest of the world that you're modern and forward thinking.
Right.
And you don't necessarily think, well, now I've been given a choice. I don't have to do this for this reason. I can do it because I love it. And certainly as a child, I always chose patterned wallpaper.
Yeah.
And my sister at one time had a job in a, I don't quite know how to describe the shop. It was one of those sort of curtain fabric shops, you know, that sell lace curtains and things.
Right.
But he also had dress fabrics. And I remember buying this bullfighter fabric and making myself a skirt because I always sewed and just loving it.
Yeah.
Just loving the sort of, I mean, in some sense, pattern's nonsense because, you know, the scale's all wrong to your body. I mean, you know, got these sort of bulls kind of running around your skirt.
Yeah.
But there's something thrilling about that, about playing with scale.
Yeah, and kind of embodying an image, like climbing inside an idea.
Exactly. And because my father was Belgian, in fact, our family was split. I and my father were Belgian. My sister and mother were English.
Okay.
And because my father was Belgian, we spent a lot of time travelling in Europe as children. You were aware right from the start of other cultures. And you never saw them as a sort of them and us. It was just, and I think that's really underpinned my whole life, that I, of course, I don't believe that I'm like everybody else. I'm very aware of having, you know, lived in Britain for the majority of my life. But I have this love of of other foreignness, of otherness, of other cultures. I mean, they make it possible for me to live. It sounds totally ridiculous, but they really do.
And I think that plays into a lot of the patterns that you've chosen. They're very much situated in place, actually, and kind of come from a certain legacy of pattern making globally, I think.
They do, yes. Yeah.
I think it would be really nice to start with your first pattern.
I probably would like to speak about the Vuillard painting.
Okay, so tell me about this. So it's an Edouard Vuillard painting, which I think is in the MoMA collection. It's called Interior, Mother and Sister of the Artist, and it was painted in 1893. Can you describe it?
Well, I have to come clean straight away and say I haven't seen it in reality. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I would love to. I don't know why I wasn't conscious of him. I mean, since I first started looking at paintings. So I'm a sort of latecomer to his paintings. But I love them. I mean, they have this sort of pitter-patter. So you're looking at sort of backgrounds that are almost eating up the foreground. And these patterns that are kind of merging and coming in and out of focus. And I think, I mean, for me, what I love about other people's art is I don't have to make it because it's already been done. But I can assimilate it. And it gives me so much. And I don't think I would ever work like him. But it does remind me of my, you know, European history.
Right.
As opposed to my British history. Because I can remember having holidays in, you know, places like Italy, where then there had been a change in time. You know, there was a time when Italian older women were dressed in black. I mean, as soon as a relative, you know, as soon as the husband died, they were in black, didn't matter what age they were. And then there was a moment when somebody flipped a switch and there were these wonderfully elegant older women dressed in fabulous patterns. And I remember saying to my mother, you could look a bit sexier, and kind of taking her shopping. It was such a terrible failure. But just that sort of feeling of, there's a kind of thing of older women being rubbed out, and we definitely become invisible at a certain point. It's a very subtle thing. But in those paintings, you can see that historically, they didn't become invisible. You can see that his elderly mother is dressed in pattern, and the wallpaper and the tablecloth and the.
Because in the painting, it does. Is that the elderly mother sat down? Because she is in black.
She is in black. No, you're right. I'm very good at reinventing things to suit my own story. I mean, you know, give myself a smack. But it's sort of how my brain works. So often I'll see something and then my brain will carry on with it.
Right.
And so if you ask me to describe a show I've been to, I've edited out everything I didn't like.
Yeah.
And I've oomphed up everything that I liked. Yeah. So I've just done that with the painting. I've oomphed up everything I liked.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about how people use information is it's like a prop. It's like you have this support behind you, which is the history of things. And you don't need to refer to them. You just need to know they exist.
So you mentioned something really nice when you were speaking with the curator of the exhibition, Eleanor Morgan, about how your university years are like the store cupboard for your future life. And I thought that was really articulate and poignant in a way that I'd not quite understood before, but there's something really special about that.
Yes, I count myself as so lucky because we were allowed to play. And you think the minute you forget how to play, you've lost something absolutely vital in your life. I'm not saying you can't still have an enjoyable life, you know, and everybody has their own shape to how they use this time that we have. I'd had an absolutely rubbish education. I mean, not over egging it. And retrospectively, I can see it as really useful.
Right.
I didn't know any rules.
Mm.
And so when I got to art college, the one thing I knew and still knew was how to make a mess.
Right.
For a long time, I worried that I'd never make an end product because somehow this fiddling around would never come to an end.
Mm.
So the sort of miracle was when things started to emerge and then disappear again in the sort of ability to just let go and go into free fall again.
I'm really interested to understand a bit more about your childhood and how pattern played a part in your upbringing.
Yes, I think, well, again, I'm going to say how lucky I was to have these two contrasts in my life, living in England and having, you know, my mother's family. She came from quite a large family. And then having this, I'll call it a European side to the family, because my father was Belgian, but his mother was French, which meant there was a whole French family as well.
Right.
And I can remember the interior in Belgium, but I have a much more vivid memory of French interiors, and particularly their use of wallpaper, which included papering the ceiling.
Okay.
And papering the inside of cupboards.
Yeah.
And the places.
With the same paper?
No, not necessarily. And so this extraordinary richness, I just loved that. I just loved it. Because I have this thing about wallpaper where I see it as the place for the imagination. So other people see as claustrophobic, I see as liberating. And when I was a child, I had this sort of pagoda wallpaper. I mean, why on earth did I choose that? We'll never know. But there was some wonderful attraction to having these sort of Chinese motifs.
Some sort of playhouse in your imagination,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, a kind of foreign land you could go to. And, yes, and this sort of way of... And then this way in France of using wallpaper and including the ceiling. I mean, when did you last see a wallpapered ceiling?
Yeah. Yeah, the closest I can think is when you go to a sort of Italian or maybe even Portuguese restaurant and there's a kind of embossed tin ceiling. Have you seen those?
Oh, God, I love embossed tin.
They're really amazing.
Yes.
And they feel, I mean, it feels so much like you've kind of walked into some sort of cave of pattern or something.
Yes.
It kind of envelops you in a way that is quite rare to encounter.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the things that I really love about travelling.
Mm.
You know, I've been lucky to go to sort of places like Morocco or even Syria. And I call them plain on the outside and patterned on the inside, which is so interesting.
Meaning that on the when you approach a building,
it seems
quite
blank.
Plain.
Yes,
right.
Blank.
Yeah.
And then you go inside and it's the feast for the eyes.
Right.
Yes, and so wonderful. But I'm going to step back a bit and sort of talk about the British family, because I'm sort of focusing on the European family. And I had these wonderful aunts. And the aunts all had rather good jobs. And so they loved to spend money. And and they hadn't married. They'd stayed at home. And they liked to spend money on changing the interior of the house.
Right.
And so they would buy sort of things like G-Plan furniture. And then they would have... I just remember, and I always talk about this, the arrival of orange paint, you know, which was such a kind of radical thing. Because you have to think that there was a total change in colour palette that happened.
Right.
And when people talk about the sort of 50s and then the 60s, really there was a moment when somebody turned the light switch on.
Right. I kind of associate orange maybe with the 70s. Did it really kind of surge then? But
I think it came a bit earlier than that. I mean, because if you watch, I mean, I loved Vogue magazine.
Right.
And if you looked at clothes in Vogue, they would arrive, and then about 5 years later, people would be wearing those clothes on the street. So everything's always been a sort of slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
In order for the public to accept them, there's an early drip feed.
Yeah.
And first of all, they feel affronted by it.
Mm.
And then gradually they do it themselves.
We get indoctrinated with the idea.
Yes, it's fascinating to watch.
Pattern on pattern plays a big part in your work. Thinking about the painting works where there's many, many canvases sort of piled up. Is it called Who Knows?
Yes.
Is that one of the ones in the show?
It is, yes.
It's just so great to kind of see the reverberation of one thing next to another. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I can. But it's, you know, it's an old painting. It's from the 90s, mid-90s. So it's you have to be a bit careful to not talk about it as you see it now, to try and remember what it was like then. In order to carry on working, you evolve a continuing relationship with your work. So the work doesn't get fixed in the moment.
Yeah.
You see it through new eyes. And that would be the same with the carpet pieces. I see them through new eyes now. So whatever reason I was doing them for then, it'll have a different meaning for me now.
Right.
But there were very simple rules when I was doing those, I call them composite paintings. So I'd make individual canvases, and there's a whole mix of things. So there's painting, photography, fabric, painting on fabric.
Right.
And because I think it's really interesting the way that people edit. There's a kind of mental editing that goes on that tells you this is right. And I and many other people go, why? Why is that right? Because when I walk down the street, when I'm in a room, when I'm travelling on the tube, everything isn't honed down. Everything's quite full on and beefy.
Right.
You know, do you just think colours of cars, texture of the pavement, garden walls, what front gardens are like, front doors, stained glass windows, curtains in windows. I mean, my God, what a soup.
Yes.
But then we come to make work beefy and we soup. Think, a little bit of blue paint in the corner. Oh, is that a bit risky? No, it's not risky. You don't have to be that cautious if it doesn't suit you. So I really wanted the paintings to be as rich as our experience of life is rich. You can't be like that all the time. And of course, it ends at the edge of the painting.
Yeah.
So it's still managed. But I had a very simple rule, which was if you put something next to something, it's not new. You don't want it to be neutral. You want them to feed off each other in some way. And if they don't feed off each other, take it away. So I would have a pile of paintings and I'd pin them up in relationships on the studio wall. And if I came in the morning and I thought, no, it would just get unpicked and start again.
Right. And are you following, is it quite instinctive, sort of a gut feeling?
Yes, it has to be, and just instinctive.
And does sleeping on it, you mentioned coming in the morning, I kind of like that idea that those fresh eyes revisit it and you can see all the problems that you couldn't see at the end of the day, the night before.
Yes.
It's sort of cleansed.
Yes. Yes. Your brain's clear and your eyes are clear. And it was especially important when I was working on the carpets because I used to turn them over at night. So that when I came in the morning, I'd have to turn them over again. And I always found them shocking. I mean, I was just sort of shocked. And then I'd have to settle down and make friends with them again. And so that was the case with the... It was less the case with the paintings because I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why different materials, you have a different response to materials in different places and different kinds of materials.
Yeah. Do you find if you dress a certain way or dress yourself in pattern, it can be somehow empowering?
I can't really answer that. Mm. I mean, that sounds strange, doesn't it? I've had a more radical relationship over the years with my haircuts than with my clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But I realise, very colourful friends. And I have a very close friend called Carol McNichol, who has, for many, many years, worn lots and lots of colours and patterns together. And another friend called Babs Hannon, who's the same, wears just wonderful clothes.
Mm.
And Sylvia Zuronek, who's a performance artist. I mean, you know, Sylvia enters the room, everybody knows.
Mm.
And I tend to see myself as the brown mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Going out with a shield. And the shield is attracting the attention. And I can get on quietly in the background.
The shield being the work?
Being the people. The other people.
Right.
Yes, the right. Other people.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the lifts that you made for Mima. One of them kind of features sort of mannequins in a shop window, this kind of repeat patterning through photography. And there's a really great project that you did in Cleethorpes where you did these kind of repeat lollipops and sort of photographic layering. I think I want to ask something about the way that you gather an image in that sense, and that it actually doesn't go through a huge amount of filtering before being sort of represented as a tiled image. And also about the kind of obvious as a sort of almost like the first idea is the best idea. You think of the seaside, you think of helter-skelters and lollipops, and that's the, you know, there's something quite fabulous about embracing that. Can you talk a bit about the power of the obvious?
Yeah, I love the obvious. I mean, for heaven's sake, don't avoid it.
Yeah.
Because it may be the answer. And for me, it often is.
Mm.
And you feel a little bit shy when you're sort of proposing it to people, because they're going to think, whoa, that's dumb. But then, you know, they're sort of thrilled with it. Showing places to themselves, it's not a bad thing.
Mm.
It's not a bad thing. I can remember when we'd lived in America for a year, coming back to England and suddenly seeing England. And you think, we take our surroundings for granted, but they're having an effect on us.
Yeah.
So showing people the obvious, but in a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, they are really dumb, those pictures. They are, you know, they're not photographs, they're snaps.
Right.
And they're never altered. I don't crop them. I don't flip them. I just repeat them.
Mm.
And, you know, they might be upside down, but they'll never be back to front.
And what happens for you in the process of the repetition?
Oh, I just love it. I love it because you get this sort of build-up of detail. And then gradually, this accumulation of images creates something extremely physical.
Mm.
You know, it alters the wall. I mean, there's the wallpaper in the Gallery 3.
Yeah.
And if you're leaning against the bit that isn't patterned and you look along, the wall is rippling.
Right.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. So they create this sort of illusory space that I find absolutely thrilling.
Mm.
You know, I sometimes think, well, I never needed to take drugs because they're kind of, I have visual drugs, you know, they're kind of mad.
Yeah.
Totally mad. And I'm in love with those lifts.
Yes. Well, it's nice because you're really surrounded and
yes.
kind of, back to this idea of being enveloped or being in the childhood bedroom surrounded by pagodas. It's kind of,
yes.
Does it feel like a cocoon for you, or a kind of safe space in that noise?
Well, we have to mention the mirrors.
Yes.
Because the mirrors extend the space.
Mm.
So there's this thing where you have the original space and then these other strange pockets moving out and mm-hmm. pushing the pattern further away. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think you would imagine it would make it feel claustrophobic, but it's like somebody'd pop me into heaven.
Right.
It's so, I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but that's how it is.
No,
it's,
I get it.
I find it so reassuring. You know, I'm often looking for reassurance. Mm. It's all right. You're all right.
I think as well, that idea of reflecting a place back on itself, obviously there's always mirrors or often mirrors in a lift. It would feel very different, actually, if you were in that space without a mirror.
Oh, it'd be terrible.
But the fact that you become part of that image and you're kind of your own image is implicated in that repetition. It's something kind of amazing. Let's go on to the next fabric, if we may, or the next pattern even. Yeah. Tell me about this.
It's a serving dish made by my great friend Janice Chalenko. I've got another friend, Glenys Barton, and she left the Royal College the year before me, but we had already become friends. And she was out in the big wide world and teaching at Camberwell. And she met Janice, and Janice hadn't been at the Royal College. And Janice was always quite sort of, I don't know, how can I explain her? She had opinions, that's the best way to say it. And she was always sort of trashing us, really. And I finished up becoming very good friends with Janice and living two doors down from her. And seeing her work evolve, because Janice had a studio pottery background, so she was very much a sort of repetition potter, brown glazes, you know, kind of something you would associate with a not suburban Peckham,
right?
But, you know, the countryside somewhere. And Camberwell at that time had a fantastic textile department. And she got to know this man called John Hinchcliffe, who is a rag rug maker. And John wanted to change his work. And Janice went on to love collaboration, but I think probably had a yen to change her work.
Mm.
And they collaborated together. And John taught Janice some very basic textile techniques, like printing with sponges and things like that. And to begin with, the pots changed. They were quite simple changes, like quite a neutral background of a kind of whitish glaze with maybe a grey line and little green spots. And the one thing that's very important to know about ceramics is you're always working blind.
Right.
You're not going to know. It's in your head, in your imagination. You hope that's what's going to come out of the kiln. It may not be. So she started off very simply. And then gradually over the years, the glazes became richer. The patterns just more extraordinary. And I love cooking. And I love choosing what I serve food on.
Mm.
And so Janice's ceramics and my joy of cooking were a match made in heaven. And so that thing of a sort of sensuality in life, I mean, don't deny yourself pleasures every day.
Mm.
You know, even if we're in a hurry, using a beautiful cup.
Yeah.
Even if you think you're not really aware of it. Don't know, just take the trouble.
Yeah.
And that's the gift that Janice has given me.
Mm. So this particular platter is almost has the feeling of like a marbled paper, I think. It's sort of got, and then there's kind of flowers emerging in
that's
there.
That's right.
Sort of pansy or something. But it's because of the way that the glaze is interwoven with one another.
Yes.
They kind of create this quite... Well, it looks to me like it's quite chance-driven, but perhaps it's quite controlled.
It's a balance.
Yeah, yeah.
So the more you know your materials, the better you are at playing the game.
Mm.
And she fired in a gas kiln, and so there's a lot that... And it's a reduction firing, so that brings out these wonderful colours. But it means that glazes move a lot.
Right.
But the consequences of that, the sort of high risk is high gain.
Yeah.
And there is this thing of me liking things being layered.
Right.
Because you can see there's a sort of, there is a background, and then on that background are the flowers.
Yeah, yeah.
And definitely. It's not a kind of, It's not a neutral background. The background has all qualities of its own.
I think I'd love to ask you a bit about the kind of relationship in your ceramic work between the kind of inlay, the emboss, the glaze, this idea of layering within ceramics, and that there's different applications of pattern to the surfaces or from within. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, because that's something I've when I really got into ceramics, I absolutely loved it. But you can see as you go through the exhibition that my relationship to the clay, to the pattern, to the glazes changes quite dramatically. There's sort of two stages to it. There's a moment in America where I'd been trying to shake myself free of a rule that pattern should follow form.
Right.
So I'd been trying to liberate myself from that. And I always say, you know, Japanese prints with a great sort of nudge, but you need something else. And New York was the something else.
Okay.
And New York's changed. It's been tidied up a lot. It was really messy. And it had a lot of layering of pattern. But of course, you get all the grid patterns in the high-rise building and the reflections over which architects have no control.
Mm.
And those are random and they're squiggly and they're wonderful. So this relationship of pattern to form got a real nudge in New York. And also, you had to sort of start again in terms of materials. And you just, I don't have a kind of traditional ceramics background. I don't have a notion of truth to materials or that I have to mix a glaze to be authentic. You know, and the wonderful thing was there's a fantastic hobby market in America.
Mm.
So you could buy packet glazes. You had a great choice of clays that you could use. And in New York, I just by chance found that there were these compatible clays that you could fire together. So that was the first stage, was just making sheets of pattern clay and then cutting them out and building things. When I came back to England, and after I'd recovered from the shock of being back in England, which was pretty traumatic, that took a huge shift because then I was treating the clay much more like somebody's buying material to make a dress.
Mm.
But they don't care if the pattern crosses the seams.
Right.
You know, it's brought up to sew properly, so you know, you have a sense of it being one surface wrapped around the body. I just threw that out of the window. And I would make, just a random thought would come into my mind. Oh, I'm just going to put some stripes on this bit of clay. Oh, the other side is going to have a completely different set of things on. I'm going to grate a bit of clay here, or I'm going to put some splodges on or some dots.
Mm.
I mean, I can't overemphasize how random it was. And the thing was, it had no relationship to the form. So it's like you'd split your brain in half.
Right.
So nothing is pre-planned.
Mm.
Everything is sort of moving along. And things are talking to each other. And they come out of the kiln. And you re-establish the relationship with the object. Because you don't have a sense of anticipation of what's going to arrive.
Right.
And then you respond to that. And you apply glaze or you don't apply glaze to parts of it. And then you fire it again. And the only moment when you know what you're doing is when you do the final firing, if you do a third one. And that's enamel. And the enamel is the colour it's going to be.
Right.
So it's like applying a layer of paint.
Yeah.
And knowing that relationship is fixed and it's not going to change. If you hate it, you can fire it to a higher temperature and it'll burn away.
Right.
So you haven't burnt your boats.
Mm.
But it's, it's all about intelligent risk-taking, I would say.
Yeah, I like that, intelligent risk-taking. Allowing there to be that element of chance, but also as much control as you're able to have.
Yes, or as little,
as you choose
yes.
to have.
Yeah.
I find, and it's kind of hard to articulate, but I find the relationship between an inlay, or particularly in your carpet works and in some of the small bone china pieces where it's sort of embedded into the clay, there's something very emotional about something that's inlaid alongside something. Do you know what I mean by that? There's almost like the two materials have this, it's quite sexy or something. There's like a relationship that happens between them that is powerful in a way that I can't quite articulate. Do you identify with that?
Well, I don't have a way of describing it, because everything you try and turn to, you think, no, it's not that.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because for a long time, I loved tattoos. I mean, they were so unfashionable, and they're so fashionable now. But I was obsessed with Japanese, you know, tattoos that, obviously, for the kind of gangsters, because I thought these people are never naked.
Right.
So they are fully clothed because of their tattoos, because their skin. Well, I mean, obviously our skin is us, but in their skin,
right,
is so entirely patterned. And so they, yeah, like I say, they're never naked. Mm. So that thing of a piece of clay never being naked, a sheet of paper not being a blank sheet of paper, you know, what is the difference between being naked and having any kind of clothing, you know, whether you're an object or a person?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tell me about your next pattern, the Japanese kimono. Can you describe it?
It's quite hard to describe, isn't it? Because it's as if somebody had been shopping for wrapping paper and they'd shredded it into sort of raggedy strips, and they'd glued the strips together. So the patterns don't bear any relationship to each other at all.
It's amazing from that sense. It feels so contemporary and also bizarre. Like, yes. I'm amazed it got made.
Yes, and it's not what we associate with Japan,
yeah,
is it? I mean, I don't know. What do you think? 60s?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, what was the provenance of it? How did it come to you?
Well, I bought it in Japan.
Right.
Lisa Milroy and I share a passion for pattern. And the painter Lisa Milroy. And we went to Japan together. We both absolutely love Japan. She spent quite a lot of time there. Mm. Knows enough Japanese to be really helpful. She uses a lot of materials in her work, so she was doing a lot of shopping. But we knew we wanted to go and look at kimonos. I think Lisa might have bought 4 kimonos, and they were fascinating because you could really identify them. A kimono with a little kind of scene, rather like my wallpaper, but it might be more European, you know, because there's really interesting swap-overs.
Yeah.
Yes, but yeah, I spotted this and I thought, you are mine. Yeah. You are mine. Because I'm always looking for things that will reassure me that I have my place in the world and that my brain isn't completely warped and it's all right for me to be myself. And I mean, it goes back to, I mean, I think pretty well all the things we talk about will be like that.
Mm.
They're either things that somebody else has done that are fine because I don't have to do them, or things that sort of enrich my life in a way, but always in that way of it's like this soothing voice. It's all right. It's all right.
That's really
beautiful. It'll be all right. And this kimono is, it'll be all right. Mm. Because look, it happened in Japan.
Yeah, it gives it a sort of an authority or something somehow, doesn't it?
Yes, and those sort of things about Japanese culture. You know, I mentioned the tattoos and Japanese prints. I mean, years ago, the British Council took me to Tokyo and Kyoto right at the beginning of the 80s. But one of the things that I learned when I was there, because I was going to have to give this lecture, was there was a very different attitude in Japan to the inside of things.
Mm-hmm.
The inside of garments, inside of boxes. So a plain box would have this gorgeous inside.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating from that perspective, the idea of who the decoration is for and whether you're decorating to peacock or to kind of present or to sort of more internally bolster or support.
I mean, it comes back to the tattooing, doesn't
yeah, it?
Yeah,
it does.
I mean, which was originally started as if you were a criminal. You were marked,
right.
Physically marked as a criminal. And then they took it on to become their own way. So you think of this sort of layering of a body. Every single possibility is sort of built up. And I'm so interested in those secret messages. And in England, it turns out for men it's just socks and maybe a handkerchief.
Yes.
And you think, my goodness.
Yeah, it's bleak.
Yes, it is bleak. But in other cultures, yes, it's far... It's sort of, and I just love that. I mean, I love the fact that things don't have to be public. I do really like that idea of public and private. And I think that's one of the things that you think about with your work. You don't have to tell everybody everything, because you also want people to experience things themselves and have their own response.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to prescribe it too much.
No.
Do you ever wear the kimono or do you have it as an object?
I have a lot of moth in my house. It stays wrapped up.
Right.
So it would be hanging.
Yeah.
If that was a possibility, but I don't want to discover it with
yeah.
a kind of moth nest in it. I've worn it once when I was dressed by a Japanese person.
Okay.
And I don't feel the need to wear it.
So it leads nicely on to the next pattern, which is your Welsh coat, which is something that you wear.
It is something
I
wear.
I've seen you arrived today in it.
Yeah, I love my Welsh coat.
So tell me about this.
Yes. It's a wonderful set of colours. There's blue, there's orange. And what I love about colour relationships is when you put two colours together, neither colour stays the same.
Yeah.
So you think, is that the same blue throughout? As it sort of appears in another colour combination, you think, surely not. But it is.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about weaving as well, isn't it? It's the orange becomes a sort of softer orange than the combination of the blue and orange. And then there's a sort of mossy green. And... But this very clear pattern, it's not a fuzzy pattern.
No.
And it's, I think that's, it'll be from the 60s, because within the history of Welsh weaving, which is such a rich history, this is the most sort of, what I would say, the sort of most distinctive.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's become sort of emblematic in Wales. You know, you get a kind of... This isn't the absolutely classic pattern, but there is a classic pattern
that
gets reproduced.
Yeah, is that the portcullis kind of one with the sort of hash
pattern? Exactly.
And from what I could tell from my research, this one's called the Pennsylvania pattern, I think.
Oh, how interesting. There's a lot of quilt making historically in Wales.
Yeah.
And of course, when we were travelling in America, wonderful quilt making. But you see how there are certain patterns, here comes the word again, that cross... cultures. And you don't know if that's like a kind of default setting. This is where you'll start from here and you'll finish there.
Yeah.
Or if it's people travelling and carrying things with them.
Yeah. It's interesting because pattern has such a potential as a storyteller or as a placemaker. And most of the patterns we've discussed today are very firmly situated in a particular place. And I think... it's interesting your kind of heritage of being from Belgium, but living both now in both in Peckham and in Wales, and the sort of placement of yourself and wearing a Welsh coat kind of pledges an allegiance to a particular location. It sort of sends a message to the world that you've maybe got a connection to that place, or that you appreciate the craft of that place, or those places seep into the influence of your work and the way that you present yourself.
Yes, it's a sort of it's a bit like a love affair, really. You arrive, you're definitely a fish out of water. Because where Tony Stokes lives, my partner, we're in an ex-Welsh mining village. It's definitely fallen on hard times. And when you kind of look back to the history of it, you know, it had five pits. It was a thriving community with a big store. And now none of that exists anymore. They're all, the pits have all disappeared. The chimneys have been removed. I mean, there was a sort of, yeah. What can I say? I mean, I'm in Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough and where I am in Wales have so much in common. And I'd never spent any time in the countryside. So when I, with my first husband, who came, who's very much involved with the country and loved walking, but we were always visitors.
Right.
Whereas when I'm with Tony, we're there and it's his home. And I'm watching the landscape change all the time. And we love stuff. I mean, you know, we found such a kind of bedrock in our mutual love of stuff. But from very different points of view. And then gradually we've kind of, I think, I hope, learnt to really appreciate each other's eye.
Yeah.
And he's a photographer. And when we go for walks, he slows the pace down. You know, it was a Londoner. Whoosh, we've got to get there.
Yes.
I know the route. Get out of my way. Yes. There it's. Take your time. So while he's sort of thinking about how am I going to take this photograph, I'm standing still and I'm looking and I'm absorbing the colour. And please don't over-romanticise this, because these are places that have fallen on hard times. So there's a kind of combination of what nature will do, whatever you throw at it. I mean, nature is so extraordinary. It doesn't know it's surrounded by shit. It doesn't know people have thrown rubbish down. It just carries on until you've killed it. But at the same time, there's this extraordinary juxtaposition of things, you know, artists are drawn to things in decay and decline. So there are these two things playing together. So that was my introduction. And with our love of stuff and our going to just see things all the time and what we call poking around, we like to go out and poke around, you know, like a nice, call it an antiques fair, but it could, you know, could be junk or antiques. I started to spot these Welsh blankets and Welsh tapestry coats. But there's a kind that date from the 19th century, which are called narrow loom.
Okay.
Because they were made on a narrow loom, which is a sort of gift to me now that I'm working on an even narrower loom.
Okay.
Of a kind of invitation to make things in two parts. And you know you found a narrow loom blanket because it's got a seam up the middle.
Right.
And so there's a kind of, bit like with my photographs, there's a sort of peeling in half and a kind of mirroring that happens with those. And people tend to talk about them in relationship to the landscape. I would say they have no relationship to the landscape. They have a lot of feeling for what it is and how it is to weave, and the language of weaving and the playing that you can do with weaving. And, I mean, I've got a stunning reversible one that's so loud. I mean, you can see me coming from miles away. But yeah, I love it. And it's interesting in the sense that not many people were wearing them, so it was a choice to be visible. And it is interesting because it's almost, you know, sometimes people have a car that makes you toot and wave. It's a bit like a toot and wave car. It's a kind of, oh, another person who likes Welsh coats. It's a tribe.
Yes. Yeah, I think Patton has this amazing ability to be the sort of conversation starter, or the kind of the sending a little signal to some to people in the world.
Yes, that it is. Yes,
that you're aligned some way.
Yes, it is that. Yes, that somehow you share something in common.
Mm.
You don't, for the most part, you don't know what, and it's an interesting kind of choice for me where I'm always sort of playing this game of whether or not to be visible.
Mm.
I mean, I always want to be, first of all, comfortable in myself.
Yeah.
And I don't want to attract aggression, though I have done at certain times. I think I'm past that now.
Mm. Through what you wore?
Yes, through haircuts and mainly.
What was the aggression?
People didn't like the fact that they weren't sure if you were a man or a woman.
Right.
And then, well, asymmetric haircuts, of which I had very extreme ones, they took it as a personal affront. Mm. I think people, it's so difficult to imagine that you haven't done it for them.
Mm.
You've done it for yourself. That you didn't want to make them angry. You just wanted to give them a warning.
Mm.
Because I always saw the haircuts as a warning. You know, I'm not straightforward.
Yeah, not quite who you might think I am.
Yeah, because I'm, you know, I'm reasonable looking. I'm not gorgeous. I could easily be invisible. So I'm sort of sending a message out. Not now. Because I think I've done that now. I'm over it.
Mm.
I'm comfortable with myself. But as a young person, I think I wanted to sort of just warn people I'm not this, you know, not as homely as you think.
Mm.
I might be a bit awkward.
Is there a pattern that got away, or a dream pattern that you covered?
The answer is I don't know, because I haven't seen it. Yes. And the wonderful thing about museums, we are so lucky, because so many things you can go and see without caring for them.
Mm.
And I have reached a stage in my life where I think I don't want you the responsibility of looking after you.
Mm.
I'm so glad somebody else is doing it on my behalf.
Mm. But you get to go and glimpse
go
it.
Go and see it, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Or, you know, somebody else has it and I can see it in their house and I can handle it and... yeah.
Mm.
I would say that and I'm just thinking, no, you're lying. But I probably will never buy it, because it would be such a huge responsibility. When I come out of Green Park Tube Station and I'm walking to the Royal Academy, there's a carpet shop.
Mm, I know it, yeah.
Yeah, so I can be seen there like a cartoon character, nose pressed against the window.
Mm.
I would never know which carpet to buy. And when I was married to Richard Deacon, he bought me their book, because they had published a book on carpets, and they say you buy carpets with your feet.
Mm.
So if you're ever spending a small fortune on a carpet, make sure your feet are nice and clean.
Right.
And take them off.
Take off your shoes.
Shoes and socks. Your socks, and experience the carpet physically as well as through your eyes. And yeah, I don't think I want one of those carpets anymore. But for years, I thought if I ever sell one of my... Well, I have sold some of my carpets. But if I ever sold the last carpet, it would be replaced by one of those.
One in, one out.
Yeah, but I think my fear of moth, I'm afraid, has supplanted that now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to. And they are eye-wateringly expensive.
Are they antique? Mostly
no,
in that shop,
I mean,
they're new.
I hate to think, you know, I don't want to think of the sort of labour, because the threads are so fine, you know, just extraordinary. But I hope I still have a kind of chance to experience places once again. You know, like I would love to go back to Japan again, like a little pig in shit.
And finally, of all the patterns that you've chosen, which is your very favourite and why?
Terrible silence. I can't. I'm really sorry.
It's okay.
It's my mantra. If you don't have to choose, why choose?
Fair.
I can't choose.
I'll allow that. You can have all of them.
Thank you.
It's been really wonderful. Thank you so much for opening up your pattern library for me.
Well, I've loved talking to you, so thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been fabulous.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of Pattern Portraits in collaboration with Mima. You can see all the patterns we discuss over on Instagram at Pattern Portraits Podcast and keep an eye out for imminent news of the new season. One of the patterns Jackie chose is a Janice Chalenko plate. There are lots more Janice Chalenko works in the collection at Mima, so if you head there to see Jackie's show, be sure to head upstairs to see the collection too. Thanks for joining us and see you soon for season two.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.